For more information on ancient dragon Zen Gate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy to have our Eno, Gershon R. Ross, giving the talk this evening. Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
So, today turns out to be the one-year anniversary of my priest ordination here at Ancient Dragon. And so it wasn't planned that way. I only figured that out after I agreed to give this talk, but it did seem that after I noticed that I should mention it and maybe just briefly comment on it. Mostly I would like to say thank you to all of you who have supported me in this past year, especially those of you that gave me big challenges. And I don't know what I expected to happen after I got my head shaved and, you know, took my vows, but it hasn't actually been all that different. It's been sort of the same set of challenges that that came in the, you know, many years before of practice. I mean, maybe that means I'm not doing something right, but I don't think so. I feel like it's just a continuation of my life, so thank you. But one of the projects I undertook last fall was to convene a little study group. So I was a new priest at age 67, and there were a couple of other practitioners here at Ancient Dragon. You may know them, Deborah Scott and Joan Sophie. They usually come on Sundays. And they were very interested in having a group to talk about end-of-life issues, end-of-life matters. And end-of-life matters meaning aging, illness, and dying. So we did that. We talked about it, and together we convened a group of about a dozen people by invitation. I mean, it took a while to talk to people and see who wanted to do it. And then last January we got together and figured out how we wanted to structure the group. As a group we got together and we decided we would meet once a month on the third Saturday. I actually call it the third Saturday group because I don't write in my calendar dying group. and we get together for 2 hours at their house, so it's at home, which is very nice. And we start, our form is we start with a short period of zazen and we end with a short period of zazen, and then in between we have sort of relaxed discussion on some topic related to this that we sort of decide in advance. And anyone can suggest a topic, and we don't have a leader. I mean, usually the person who suggests the topic sort of leads off the discussion, but we're very lateral organized. So anyway, it's a work in progress after 7 months. And we all have some level of Buddhist practice. We decided that would be one of the criteria for people that we would invite. But other than that, we're pretty various. A few people are therapists or retired therapists. We have a French teacher. We have a carpenter. We have an ecologist. That would be me. Anyway, but we're not young. We're in our 50s, 60s, and 70s. Anyway, the reason we decided to exclude non-Buddhists was we sort of wanted to have a common worldview to discuss this matter. I don't know. So anyway, part of the invitation to join the group, Deborah sent everyone an email with the five remembrances sort of the version that Thich Nhat Hanh teaches. So these are from the Upajatana Sutta. I don't know if I said that right. Anyway, there are five facts regarding life's fragility and our true inheritance. So I'll just read them to you. I am of the nature to grow old. There's no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There's no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. And so the advice in this discourse is that these facts are to be reflected on regularly by everyone. And Thich Nhat Hanh has a brief comment that I'll share. He says, the five remembrances help us make friends with our fears of growing old, getting sick, being abandoned, and dying. They are also a bell of mindfulness that can help us appreciate deeply the wonders of life that are available here and now. A bell of mindfulness that can help us appreciate deeply the wonders of life that are available here and now. So anyway, that's the general idea of our group. We have these two major things that we're exploring. So ideas and feelings about death and dying, and then also how this relates to how we're making decisions about living our lives at this stage. So anyway, it's an extremely intimate conversation, as you can imagine, and we are getting to know each other through this conversation. And we've discovered that we do have fears. We have many questions. We have some significant differences in our thoughts and feelings about this. And people have done different things. So one person has started collecting photographs of old people smiling. She calls it the Joy in Old Age Project. And she sends them to us. And she uses them. She likes looking at them for meditation. So it's people like Pete Seeger and Nelson Mandela and Gary Snyder. You know, you could sort of see their face, right? I still hear this crinkly, joyful faces. And anyway. Another one of the people has become active in this group called the Final Exit Network and is leading some workshops on that. So I'll tell you about that. I actually have a flyer that I can put out there. But anyway, Final Exit Network used to be called the Hemlock Society. So they advise people on lots of end-of-life issues, but one of which is a little controversial. It's usually called assisted suicide. So anyway, one thing we've noticed is there is a tremendous amount of stuff in the media about these issues right now. It's probably a baby boomer phenomenon. You know, a lot of us are getting older. So there's like books and movies and conferences and articles and, you know, major movie stuff, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, we sort of share that stuff with each other, sending emails and so forth with each other. And so what we are compiling a bibliography, and I hope that will become a resource at some point. It's pretty rough right now, but if anybody has any suggestions for things to add to that, I would welcome that. But one observation I would make about all this media attention is that some of it is not, it sort of varies in its usefulness. A lot of it focuses on legal and medical advice, and I would say that some of it gives the impression that if you are really a good planner and talk to a good lawyer about this and get all the information and do all the right stuff, that you can sort of be in control of your death, which I don't think is 100% true. Although I do not... I do think it's really excellent that that people are paying attention to this and trying to be conscious of decisions and so forth. One of the topics that I'm really interested in, and I'm going to spare you, but I'm really learning everything. So I'm really interested in what happens to your body after your death, and I'm really not in favor of embalming or in burning us. What's that called?
Cremation.
Cremation. There's this, all this green burial stuff that, if you want to talk about it some other time, I'll tell you about it. It's very cool. Anyway, I would say, in terms of practical guidance, I would just recommend two people that we've been looking at their materials quite a bit. One of them, actually, Tigan, I think, knows both of these people, but the first person I'll mention is Frank Ostaseski. I'm now his Facebook friend, and I get things from him every week. He's a Buddhist teacher, is associated with the San Francisco Zen Center, and in 1980s, he's been doing this for decades. So in 1987, he founded the Zen Hospice Project, and that was the first Buddhist hospice in this country, and it was in response to the AIDS crisis when people are so fearful of being in contact with all these dying people. Anyway, I'll read you their mission. Their mission is to help change the experience of dying. We create space for living that offers the opportunity for individuals, their loved ones, and caregivers to find comfort, connection, and healing in the shared human experience. Through our pioneering model of care, we inspire each other to live fully. And then about 10 years ago, in 2004, he created this Metta Institute, which we chanted the Metta Sutta tonight, which trains people to work with ill and dying people. And I've actually done several online seminars, which are free, I don't think they're having them anymore. Anyway, the links will be on there. And they're really helpful and excellent. So anyway, the other really wise voice in this public discussion is Joan Halifax, and she's the director of the Upaya Institute, and she does a lot of things, but one of the things she does is direct the Project for Being with Dying, which is another group that trains people to work with the dying. But she's also written a lot on this topic, and she often quotes Rainer Maria Rilke, who says, "Love and death are the great gifts that are given to us. Mostly, they are passed on unopened." So it's pretty obvious how love is a gift. It's not maybe as obvious how death is a gift, and particularly maybe not obvious how to open that gift. So that's what I've been sitting with. That's what sort of where being in this discussion for the past 8 months has taken me, to sort of think about that question. And I recently listened to a Dharma talk by Blanche Hartman, who I guess is in hospice herself now.
Not quite, but
in which she's
getting,
quite ill.
Yeah.
Anyway, in her talk, she quotes the Mahabharata, Indian classic. Anyway, a great sage is asked, "Sir, of all the things you've observed in life, what is the most amazing?" And he says, "That a man, seeing all around him die, never thinks that he will die." So, duly noted, right? It's an obvious fact, and we have had our attention called to it. So I have found myself reading autobiographies. Mark Twain said, "The fear of death follows from the fear of life. A man who lives fully is prepared to die at any time." So my idea is to read autobiographies of fearless people who have led fearless lives. So just in the past month, I've read three different autobiographies. Philip Glass, Oliver Sacks, and Bernd Heinrich. And they're very different people, but they have a lot in common. They're all in their 80s. They're all still alive. And they all really have invented brilliant lives, original lives for themselves. And so I admire them. I want to learn from them. So I'll share a little with you about each of them. So Philip Glass was born in 1937, which makes him 78. And so he's a musician, and he made his own terms for what success is. He writes in his autobiography, he doesn't like do it in this uppity way, like I don't do what people tell me. He just says what he did, you know. He went off to college at U of C when he was 15 years old, graduated when he was 19, then he went to Juilliard, and then he went to study with Nadia Boulanger in Paris and, you know, delved into Mozart and Bach. And but, you know, he still drove a cab into his 40s, even though, you know, because he was interested in making music and he just was not complaining, not apologizing, not regretting, just sort of doing what was in front of him. You know, he didn't brag, but he clearly has this intense discipline. And he worked with just about everyone interesting in the 20th century. Get this, he worked with people like Allen Ginsberg, Twyla Tharp, Doris Lessing, Samuel Beckett, Martin Scorsese, Saul LeWitt, Leonard Cohen, you name them, that was interesting. And he made art and did music and other theater and so forth with him. So I just finished the book so inspired that he wasn't a self-conscious, like, striver for fame. He just wanted to make good art. And I shouldn't put him in past tense because he might live another 20 years for all we know. Anyway, I also found out that we have a few things in common. So he's a lifelong vegetarian, and he practices yoga and Tai Chi and Qigong and Tibetan Buddhism. And anyway, so I put him out there just as an example of a brilliant life for us. So Bernd Heinrich, you might not have heard of him. He is an ecologist born in Poland, and probably wouldn't have ever come to the U.S. except for World War II, and his family had some extraordinary experiences. But anyway, he moved to the U.S. Right after the war. And what he's writing is all about is nature. So he's written these fabulous books about ravens and bumblebees and owls and so forth. But he's also an ultra-marathon runner and a fantastic artist. But he's written this book called Life Everlasting, The Animal Way of Death. And he was interested, his friend who was diagnosed with an illness that was going to kill him pretty soon, read him a letter and said, hey, Bernd, I'm dying. When I die, can I bury my body at your field station? Because I don't want to be, you know, in a casket in a cemetery. So he was sort of interested in that. And he sort of studied what we can learn from animals about death, and it's an absolutely fascinating book. You read about everything from dung beetles to birds. But anyway, I could quote so many things, but this is how he ends the book. I just think it's so beautiful. He says, "We deny that we are animals and part of the wheel of life, part of the food chain. We deny that we are part of the feast." I love that. "And seek to remove ourselves from it, even though we kill and consume animals by the billions. But not one animal is allowed to consume us, even after we're dead, not even the worms. We need a new creation story that connects us to nature and to others, one that can give us strength, that can make us real rather than rich. Nature, religions, and science coincide on the real. Kinship with each other and with the mountains and prairies, oceans and forests. I'm talking about beliefs built on facts that we can all agree to and that transcend individual deaths. Nature is the ultimate standard of reality, and from what has been revealed so far, I see the whole world as an organism with no truly separate parts. I want to be connected to the grandest, biggest, most real, and most beautiful thing in the universe as we know it, the life of Earth's nature. I want to join in the party of the greatest show on Earth, life everlasting. Doesn't make you feel bad about dying. I really like that. So anyway, the last person I'll share a little bit is Oliver Sacks, and you probably know him as this sort of old guy with a beard and so forth, but the cover picture on his book is his young stud on his motorcycle. He's really cool. He did a lot of stuff besides being this genius neurologist. So he wrote all those books that you probably heard of, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and many others. So he was looking into people's, the minds of abnormal, and he was sort of looking, to me, he's like looking for the true self in those abnormal minds. He wrote about it just brilliantly, but anyway, he did so many other things. He played the piano, and he actually set a state record in California for lifting 600 pounds when he was a resident. And he all this motorcycle riding, and he studied cycads, which are these ancient plants. Anyway, when he was 17, he told his mother, who was one of the first women surgeons in England. Mm-hmm. His whole family was doctors. In fact, he said he came to the States because there were too many Dr. Saxes in England. he told her he was homosexual. And she told him he was an abomination. And they both got over it eventually. You know, it didn't ruin either of their lives. And they ended up with an okay relationship, even after that just horrible experience. So anyway, he's 82 now, and he wrote this beautiful op-ed in the New York Times when he got his diagnosis, and he's had various cancers, but this one's really going to kill him. So he says, when people die, they cannot be replaced. They leave holes that cannot be filled, for it is the fate, the genetic and neural fate, of every human being to be a unique individual, to find his own path, to live his own life, to die his own death. I cannot pretend I'm without fear, but my predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved. I've been given much, and I have given something in return. I have read and traveled and thought and written. I've had an intercourse with the world, the special intercourse of writers and readers. Above all, I've been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet, and that in itself has been an enormous privilege and adventure. So, those are three amazing people. And they're just like you and me, right? I mean, they're just people. And when I think about dying, and then I think, oh, okay, I just need to make the most of this life, because it really is a gift and a privilege. So, I think that's what that's about, opening this gift of death. But maybe I thought I was going to do a Dharma talk without quoting Gary Snyder, and I'm not. I'm trying to end with him because he is among my favorite teachers. And he was on NPR recently, and Linda Wertheimer, who's one of my least favorite commentators, asked him, so how do you feel about being alive, Mr. Snyder? So what a question. And he gave the perfect answer. He said, it's wonderful. Every moment is really interesting. And I'm grateful to be alive. And I'm ready to die whenever it happens. So I'll end with that. And thank you very much. And I'm very interested in hearing your thoughts and comments. And especially interested in any thoughts you have for things for us to put on our bibliography. Oh, can I say just one other thing, which is that Tygen had suggested, and maybe this is a good focus group to see if it's a good idea, that maybe sometime in the next 12 months we have like an afternoon seminar. Not to be taught about this stuff, but sort of to share some of these materials and thoughts and ideas. So maybe we'll do that one of the Saturday afternoons if people think they would sign up for it.
So thank you very much, Laurel. Wonderful. talk. Could you just repeat the thing about being a sentient being in the last quote?
From Oliver Sacks, yeah. He says, above all, I have been a sentient being, a thinking animal on this beautiful planet, and that in itself has been an enormous privilege and adventure. That's what we want in life, right? Adventure.
Yes. Any sentient beings here have any comments?
I have a lot.
Great. That's what we want.
You know, my mother died last year, and my father died the year before. And it wasn't a sad thing. They were 89 and 87 years old. But being, I'll be 65 next month, ever since there's been this constant thought about how am I going to finish these last years of my life on Earth, you know? And so far, it's not working out real well, you know, for me. And I use a football metaphor. I'm in fourth quarter, first and 10 on the 20-yard line, 8 yards ago or something. But I just don't, you know, I went to school to try to further myself to do something in retirement that would really work out. Well, it didn't work out the way I'd hoped. So, but the death thing doesn't bother me so much as what am I going to do with my last remaining years? Mm-hmm. So that's been my my real kind of issue, you know, the last couple of years is what am I going to do with that? And I'm in the process of trying some different things, but I don't know. Death is the finality of it is just so. So, unlike you, I cremation is something I would, and putting a river near my country home, that would be my place there also. But it's interesting. My wife works with elders. She's a teacher at North Park University. And she had developed this thing where she had a group of students with an elder that were like 70, 80, 90 years old. One was a 93-year-old Russian teacher. And I think what's cool about that is the kids learn so much from these elders when you group them together and stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's so many things that elders can do that we aren't allowing them to do when we put them in these homes and stuff. And we don't allow them to be who they can really be. And the program has really taught me a lot, you know. And it's pretty interesting. But a lot of things that are really interesting with the elders. Oh, they're going on right now. And that's not all. Thank you.
Jerry.
One of my, my best friend Roy is 89 now. And about 4 years ago, he decided he was going to give his body to science. So he investigated what to do, and he found out he had to go through a mortuary because they pick up the body and doesn't take it to the science center in the hospital or the school. And his local funeral brother wanted $1,200 to do this. And he called me up and he was just like, how can they charge me that to do this? What are they doing for me? Yeah. So I was friends with the Rago brothers, the wife of the Rago brother. And I said, call the Rago brothers and see what they'll do. So I called them up and they said, okay, no problem. Go on this website, download this form, fill it out, send it to me. When the time comes, we'll take care of it. And he said, okay, well, how much? He said, no, Charlie, there's nothing to do here. So he's filling out the forms and getting everything ready. And this is going on for a couple months. Every day he has another little story. And I'm thinking, well, he's taking this really well. This is kind of cool. One day he calls me up and he says, okay, I'm signing this form. We're talking about me here. And it kind of made me feel good because I was wondering, does he not get it? You know, what's going on here? Is he putting this together? But, you know, we sort of talk about do we know we're dying, but kind of we do it, you know. Kind of we don't, so it was an interesting
kind of we do and kind of we don't, yeah.
Yeah. There's one other funny story about this. He's got this nephew who he made to be executor of his estate, who it was fine until he went to his nephew's son's wedding. And I don't know what happened to that wedding, but he came back thinking his nephew's got rocks in his brain and he's just dumb as a doorknob and he can't handle it. Which was like a year and a half ago, and now he still tells me, I guy came off as my executor. You know, and I know what you're supposed to know. Your executor is up. The guy came off as my executor. If I die, he's my executor. I'll kill myself. He's got this real powerful sense about, you know, and he's getting very, you know, he's 89 years old. And, you know, he gets this, you know, yeah, the clock's ticking. It's interesting to watch him go through that process.
Our conversations have been about relationships with family or friends, which is, of course, the other thing that happens as you get older is that more of your family and friends are getting ill or we're losing them. I mean, it's not a therapy group, so it's, you know, we're not coming up with therapy, but it's interesting to be talking about these things the way we talk about other things, rather than having it be sort of this other category of conversation that somehow only happens under certain circumstances. You know, it feels much more like integrated into normal conversation, whatever that is. I think that's been helpful for me and healthy. Although sometimes it's jarring for people. I say to a friend, I learned this new thing that you can get buried in a pod with a tree seed and then you'll be part of a forest that grows up. People are like, I don't want to hear about that.
That might be cool to be a tree in a
forest. Other people say, yeah, can you pick what species of tree?
I want to be an oak.
So, it's interesting.
You mentioned doing a Saturday seminar. I think this is a wonderful topic. It's, you know, the great matter of life and death, it says on the Han out front. And so I hope we have it, not just one, but maybe an ongoing every several months Saturday seminar. And I would certainly be interested in coming. And maybe you could, other people are in our Sangha are in this group, Jane, mm-hmm, and Deborah and Joan and Margaret. So maybe this can be something that people in our Sangha can do regularly. I think it's really healthy.
I hope so. Let me tell you about these workshops since I said I would. So these are called Taking Control at the End of Life, and there are four of them. And thinking out what we want at life's end, that's sort of medical stuff, advanced directives and appointing a healthcare agent, that's sort of legal stuff, Oregon-style laws, their strengths and limits, and then the other one is like, what are our options? A little more open. But anyway, we can, I suppose, make some copies of that and put it up front. They're on Wednesday afternoons, which is probably not convenient for working people. I think they assume a lot of people that might come in might be retired people.
Other comments or responses or questions? It's such a rich topic, and all of us, you know, one way or another, are involved. Yes, Mike.
I think like you said, with these workshops on Wednesday, because I assume that, like, you know what people think about this, and like,
right, our old people, right?
Man, this is really not going to do it. I think I've been thinking about this ever since I've been thinking, I think. Growing up as a Catholic, there was, like, you know, a lot of these stock answers, and like, I remember even as a little kid thinking, that doesn't really satisfy these questions, like, and then it's making it worse, you know. So I think about this every night. I wake up and I go to the bathroom and it pops in my head. It still does. And so in a way, it's almost like I kind of want to learn more about, like, even like just like the, like when you're talking about these workshops, of just like the facts and basics and stuff like this. And I'm only in, you know, my early 40s, but I think it would be best to get to this earlier.
Yeah.
You know,
and there is tons of stuff online. And one thing I would recommend is this book, which is a whole bunch of stuff about, written by a doctor. It's been, so it's called Being Mortal, but Illness, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. There's also a lot of, so there are a lot of things available if you want to look for them. But then you have to sort through and decide which stuff is sort of trying to sell you something and which stuff is really helpful.
There was a Dharma talk, I can't remember the name of this, it was a really great series, and then there was like a technical error on the last one, which was really important. Like trying to get in touch with them. But just like basic things like wills, you know, and end of life care.
Right.
Even just like there seems to be such a formula for even the ritual, you know, and like, you know, I don't want to have something like that. I'm like, no, I don't. This is not me. You know, what are you guys doing? You know, somewhere where you have more control over everything. You know, pretty much laid out. And, yeah. So that would be more helpful.